If you've grown up in Michigan or elsewhere in the Midwest, you don't need us to tell you. There's been an unbelievable shift in the lifestyle, the economy, the job expectations from, say, your parents' or grandparents' day to what we face in 2013. Here in the Great Lakes, we've gone from the arsenal of democracy during World War II to the center of manufacturing, especially of automobiles, to present day, where many of those once booming factories are empty and rotting away or falling to the wrecker's ball. Writer Edward McClelland grew up in Lansing, where once upon a time a kid could go from a high school graduation ceremony straight into a GM plant and make a great living thanks to contracts won by the UAW and go right up to retirement. Well, as we all know here in Michigan, those days are gone forever. Edward McClelland's new book digs into what happened to the industrial midsection of America, including Michigan. It's called Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. Edward McClelland joins us here in the studio. You track the history of the Midwest from boom to bust, and now as we try to rebuild and find new directions, it's a big, big story. What gave you the impetus to tackle this huge story spanning so many states?
Well, I'd say a couple things. I think it can go all the way back to after I got out of college. This was in the early 90s, and there was a recession going on then, too. And a lot of us were having trouble getting full-time jobs. And I was just fascinated by the stories that these GM veterans told me, guys who had been in for 20, 25 years, about how easy it was to find work back then. I mean, and to someone like me, a Generation Xer, this was just like employment porn. Yeah. These guys would get out and they'd put in their application 2 weeks after they graduated from high school. They were on the line. A year later, they bought a house. They had a brand new car.
Cottage
they
up got north. Married.
They had a cottage up north.
Yeah.
They had a boat. And so this was, I was at that time looking back to this golden age of employment. And I think another thing that got me inspired to write it was I went to high school in Lansing, Sexton High School. At the time I went there, there were 2,000 students, and there was a booming auto plant right across the street, a Fisher Body plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was torn down about 2006, and as the jobs there declined, so did the student body. And now it's about a school of about 750. It's a Class B school. And what I ultimately found out in Lansing was that that plant was replaced by a new plant in Delta Township. It was just simply obsolete. They had to truck the bodies across town, and they wanted everything in one roof. But when you talk about a historic perspective, I think now that we're in 2013, I think we can sort of put that period of the 50s and 60s and 70s in perspective. Because growing up, you just thought, well, America's the richest country in the world.
That's the way it is.
Well, yeah, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And one of the questions I ask in the book is, was this great American middle class just a moment in history? Was it something that only existed in mid-century America? And I think it's quite possible that it was, because we were really in a period where it was a unique period in history, because we were the only country that had any industrial capacity left.
After World War II.
After World War II.
Yes.
So I don't think it's ever going to be as good as it was then.
You illustrate the rise and fall of a number of states and communities. You look at Cleveland, mm-hmm. Homestead, Pennsylvania, Buffalo and Syracuse, Decatur, Illinois, a heartbreaking story there. And of course, you look at Flint and Lansing and Detroit.
Right.
We're looking at different industries, but similar life cycles?
Sure. Well, because the industries were so well connected. I mean, the steel industry's main customer was the auto industry.
Mm-hmm.
So when the auto industry went down, the steel industry went down. And I think you can look at this as also not just a unique historical moment, but a unique geographic story. I mean, the reason that we became the industrial heartland was we were sort of right in the middle between the coal of Appalachia and the iron ore of the Upper Peninsula and northern Minnesota. And we had the means, the railroads and the lakes to bring the two together.
It was
and that's when those were the two main forms of transportation, and of course they're not anymore.
Speaking of the history, give us a history lesson. Just how good were those good times for workers and for the companies?
Okay, well, I guess I can give you a history lesson through one of the people I interviewed in the book, and that was Everett Ketchum, who's a family friend of mine. He's now 98 years old, and he was a veteran of the Flint sit-down strike in 1936 and 1937. Mm-hmm. He probably is one of the last survivors, if not the last survivor, and that was just such an important moment in the history of American labor and the
yes.
middle class. And they went on strike because they had no job security and because GM was speeding up the line, and the workers couldn't handle the stress. And he was the son of a farmer from northern Michigan, and moved on. His father moved on to Flint to work in the World War I munitions industry, and he was an apprentice making 50 cents an hour. And he joined the strike, and they got job security. They got health benefits. Mm-hmm. And he had a career, probably almost a 40-year career at General Motors. And he retired as a tool and die maker making $27 an hour. And I say that was a skilled tradesman at GM was the best job in the state because you got paid just as well as any of the white-collar workers. And he ended up working in Lansing, so you got paid just as well as, say, the fisheries biologist down in one of the state office buildings. And
sure.
you had health care for life. And so I always kid him that, Everett, you're the reason GM is going bankrupt
because you're still here.
You're still alive and you're still using health benefits. And the more health benefits you give people, the longer they live and the more health benefits they use. You know, in his lifespan, I mean, Flint went from just a very sort of small town making carriages to an industrial powerhouse and now this post-industrial wreck. I mean, I was just yesterday. 2 days ago, I drove by Buick City, and last time I'd seen it, it was still standing, and now it's gone. 28,000 mm-hmm. people worked there.
Where do you see things starting to go sour for auto workers and auto companies? I know you talk a lot about the Vega.
You
talk about the Corvair.
Well, they didn't want to make small cars in the 70s, and so they made terrible small cars. The first car I drove was a Chevette, which was a terrible car. And I remember seeing a guy in Detroit just in 2011 trying to start a Chevette, and I was not surprised that it wouldn't start. I was surprised he'd kept it running since the 1980s. And the Escort, that was a terrible car. So a lot of people of my generation drive foreign cars because they grew up on these terrible GM cars.
So was that where the worm began to turn?
Well, you can also trace it to the 1973 Arab oil embargo.
Yeah.
Gas prices went up dramatically, and that's when people became interested in small cars. And the Japanese and the Italians and the Germans, ironically the countries we had defeated in World War II and rebuilt, were the countries that were making the good small cars. So I would say that the quality of American cars, of American small cars, is just as good now as the foreign cars, but they still have that image. I see a lot of people driving the Chevy Cruze now, and which was recommended to me by an auto worker who I interviewed in the book who works at the GM Delta plant.
Mm-hmm. But there's a whole generation with a bad taste in its mouth.
Absolutely.
I'm speaking with writer Ted McClelland. His book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. I want to talk about the roots of Michigan's racial tensions because you spent a lot of time about that. And it seems to me, and maybe I got this wrong, that it really does. A lot of that traces back to these early factory days.
Yeah, you could say that in the 1940s, a lot of African Americans were moving up to work in the plants. And the first race riot in Detroit was in 1943. And some people will argue that was a race riot, and the riot in 1967 was a class riot. And Attorney General Francis Biddle recommended that no more African Americans be allowed to emigrate to Detroit because of the tensions. And also you had a lot of whites coming from the South too, and they came in and
with their inherent
they expected the social customs that they had grown up with to be continued in the North. But certainly I think that's more particular to Detroit than say to Flint or to Lansing. Because I mean Flint was the first city to elect an African American mayor. It was the first city to pass an open housing ordinance by popular referendum, and Lansing is the most biracial city in the United States. It is the city with the most people who claim two races and claim an African-American parent. So it was more a problem in Detroit, I think, than anywhere else.
Because of the riots during World War II and then 67?
Yes, right. Within 6 years, Detroit was a black-majority city.
Because that's what you say. It's less – first of all, you say it's a class riot. It wasn't a race riot.
Right. Well, because Explain. These people were – they were of course, race was an element, but
yes.
These people were crammed into very congested neighborhoods, and they were overcharged for – just basics of life like rent and
food.
Mattresses, food, and of course they were seeing what everybody else had, and it just It just blew up.
It blew up.
Right.
And as you say in your book, what was more interesting is what happened after. So that riot is the BC and the AD.
Right. And I was just interested in, you know, other cities had riots.
Yeah.
Los Angeles had two riots. Philadelphia, Newark.
And we're still paying the price today for
exactly. that. Exactly. But Detroit never recovered. It was just worse in other cities. And I suppose you can blame things like the highway system making it easy for people to flee Detroit. And, I mean, different leadership. I talk about the difference between Coleman Young's background and the background of other African-American leaders of the era. Most of the African-American leaders of that area came out of the civil rights movement. Coleman Young was a radical labor organizer.
Yes, yes. And I want to get a little more as you track the similarities and differences between Detroit, Lansing, and Flint. Let's talk about the auto workers in Lansing and Flint. How about the factors that influence the way those cities have fared, especially during the lost decade of the 2000s?
Yeah, well, I guess I come to it from a Lansing point of view, being from Lansing. But it's interesting talking to Lansing auto workers because they're almost sort of unanimous in their disdain for the militants and the work ethic of, mm-hmm. of Flint auto workers. And nobody at GM is going to say it, but Flint strikes always took longer. There were more strikes and they took longer to resolve than in other GM cities. So I really think one of the reasons that they pulled out of Flint was because the Flint auto workers never really could let go of that spirit of the sit-down strike.
Mm.
So they were dispersing them to plants all over the state where the unions didn't have that dominant feeling.
The fire
yes.
in the belly?
Yes. And in Lansing, I think they had more of a rural workforce, and Lansing was on the verge of losing its two auto plants, and they were able to convince GM to stay in town. And the mayor at the time, David Hollister, he credited the work attitudes of the Lansing auto workers as a reason that GM stayed. So I think nobody should come out and blame unions for the problems or for factories or industry going down. There's a right way to do it and there's a wrong way
mm-hmm,
to do it.
Mm.
There's a cooperative way to do it and there's an antagonistic way to do it.
Now, the book is The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. So, Ted, if we look ahead to the future, what did you find in your reporting that gave you some hope of new directions for Rust Belt cities?
Well, I found some cities doing things with high technology and alternative energy, using some of the land and some of the skills that were left over from industry in Buffalo. The picture on the cover is in Lackawanna, New York, mm-hmm. and that's the old Bethlehem Steel plant, and that's the site of the First Winds wind farm, and that's capturing the wind off Lake Erie. And then you might see that on a lot of Buffalo Bills games because that's sort of become a symbol of Buffalo. Another place I went to, I went to a place in Lansing where they're making cyclotrons, atom smashers, and they're using the skills of a lot of the guys who work there are retired auto workers. And he said, there's no other place I could do this because there's no other place that has a combination of the academic knowledge at the university and the skilled labor. They just don't value that, say, mm-hmm. in Massachusetts or New York City. There aren't the people who can actually make these things.
What about, I know you get into Detroit, you talk about urban agriculture. Does
right.
that give you any hope for something really solid to build a foundation on?
Well, it's not the ideal use for a city.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the purpose of a city is to trade goods to the countryside for food.
Yeah.
But Detroit is a food desert. I mean, there is
yeah.
a dearth of fresh food in Detroit. I had trouble buying fruit after 9 p.m.
It was a big deal that the Whole Foods just opened in Midtown.
I decided that's terrific. But mm-hmm. that's yeah. not going to reach a lot of the neighborhoods.
No.
It needs to reach.
And does one worry that as you see the young and hip and predominantly white residents maybe moving into areas in Detroit and getting more attention and services than the long-suffering black residents?
Well, see, they worry about it. I heard that from a couple people. They
yeah.
said, well, they're
are there going to be two Detroits?
Well, they said they're coming back to take it over, and we've been suffering through Detroit mm-hmm. for 40 years, and you're used to hearing the suburbanites resisting regionalization, but some of the Detroiters do too because they're afraid they're going to lose power. They're afraid the whites are going to move back in and take what they abandoned and left as a ruin. And I would certainly like to see more regionalism in Detroit as we're hearing talk of them selling their art collection. That's a treasure that belongs to the whole region. And I think in, you know, Miami, Indianapolis, Toronto, they all amalgamated, and everybody says, well, it's just politically impossible in Detroit. There's too much antagonism. But I don't know, that doesn't seem like a good excuse to me.
Why did you choose the title Nothing But Blue Skies?
Well, I heard a quote from a man in South Chicago, neighborhood of Illinois. He had grown up outside the U.S. steel plant. He said, I looked up one day and saw a blue sky, and I thought the world had ended, because this was after the plant shut down. Mm-hmm. I mean, they used to say if there's soot on the windowsills, there's bread on the table. But it's also a sense of it's a clean slate. Yeah. You can do something different. And in places like Youngstown, Ohio, they say, well, we're never going to be an industrial powerhouse, but we're going to be the best city of 70,000 we can be. And there are a lot of people in Detroit who have that freedom. I mean, if you want to do something new, you can have a bigger impact in Detroit than you can have in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles.
Hit that reset button. Edward McClellan's new book explores just what happened to the industrial midsection of America. It is called Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. And it's just published by Bloomsbury Press. It is a good read. I just really got a lot out of it. A great history lesson.
Thank you very much.